Thank you very much. I mean, this is both to Joe. We've had a wonderful collaboration and across town between UNC and Duke, and Joe's leadership of the not only the postdoc but the NIMH center that we had, and our continuing collaboration has been really important source of scholarship for us. And then, you know, more apropos to this occasion, Jeff and I have had a long run together, and have been joined as the hip, as it were, and often people confuse us, although Jeff's somewhat better looking. So we're going to talk about sort of the two arcs of work across, you know, the years that we've been working together. And I guess the more controversial of the two is about involuntary outpatient commitment or assisted outpatient treatment, and really has gained us quite a bit of, I guess notoriety would be one term, but hatred would be another, from folks who really would rather we not study this area. But we got into it in part because I had been working in the prisons in North Carolina and inpatient settings and emergency rooms in North Carolina, and knew that we had this law in the books in North Carolina that we actually used quite a bit, called involuntary outpatient commitment, and was curious about whether it could be effective, whether it could reduce rehospitalizations and revolving door situations. And so we really went into this research not with an advocacy position, but really because we were curious about, you know, under what conditions it might be effective. But unfortunately, over the years, it's become sort of the symbol of coercion in the mental health community. And so a lot of our work has been fairly controversial. But I'll talk about that because I think that's interesting in its own right, although I won't have as much time to present some of the ways we've looked at the controversy over time. So what I'm going to talk about is, can assisted outpatient treatment or involuntary outpatient commitment be effective, and under what conditions? So sometimes my colleagues who are clinicians in medicine say, well, is it effective? And the thing I try to point out to people is that outpatient commitment isn't like a drug in which it is effective or not. Outpatient commitment, or AOT, really is effective or not under a set of conditions in among a group of patients in a particular context. It isn't inherently effective or not. So I'll talk about that a little bit. And then I'll talk about the controversy around AOT, and then present a little bit of new data that we've been working on in terms of its cost effectiveness. So just by the way of background, AOT, or involuntary outpatient commitment, is permitted in all but a few states. So it exists in one form or another in virtually all the states, and it's explicitly written into statute in 44 states in the District of Columbia. Maybe 45 now, depending on there's one that whose status you question. But despite the statutory support, the fact that it's on the books in the states, it's used very variably, even within states, say in North Carolina, where we're from. Across counties within North Carolina, you see tremendous variability in whether the statute is used at all. There are really three variants of outpatient commitment, or AOT. One is as a form of conditional release for involuntarily hospitalized patients, and that's the most common form of outpatient commitment used anywhere. That is, someone's been involuntarily committed to the hospital, they are leaving the hospital, and there's a court order that bridges their release, requiring them to follow up with treatment. Another is as an alternative to hospitalization for patients who meet inpatient commitment criteria. So at the point, say, of an emergency room, the statute in that state would say, well, as an alternative to being committed to the hospital, the patient can be put under an outpatient commitment statute. That's the most prevalent form of statute. Most statutes are that kind of statute where they have the same commitment criteria for in and outpatient commitment. The problem with that statute, that variety of statute, is that for a lot of clinicians, they get worried about the liability of committing someone outpatient who meets the criteria for inpatient commitment. And then the third variant, and the variant that we have in the states that you're most familiar with, is as an alternative status for people who do not meet inpatient commitment criteria. And that would be the case in most of the new states, North Carolina being included, and New York, a so-called preventative statute in which a person hasn't deteriorated to the point where they'd be eligible for involuntary inpatient commitment, so are put on at a lower threshold onto an outpatient commitment. The controversies about AOT are many, but basically, one, advocates argue that if you had available supports or appropriate services in the community, that you wouldn't use outpatient commitment. That if you had ACT teams readily available or other types of appropriate outreach efforts, then people who are currently put on outpatient commitment might voluntarily comply and they would get more appropriate treatment. It's also a point that the advocates make is that outpatient commitment shouldn't be used as a substitute for inadequacies in the system, that all too often you have systems that are poorly funded and increasingly poorly funded, and states will use outpatient commitment as an alternative to funding and creating more appropriate services. The corollary to that argument is the point that applying coercion to an individual when you have a service system that's deficient is a way of blaming the victim, that you're putting a court order on an individual who might well comply or might well do well with services, but the judge is applying the coercion to the individual when it's really the system that's at fault and is deficient. And as a corollary to that, systems of care should be held accountable for care that's deficient, not individuals who the court order is being applied to. So we're very sympathetic to these points, and many states have actually not used outpatient commitment because they feel that these arguments should be brought to bear. Nonetheless, it's used, and we're still interested in how it's used and what effect it has. So here's some of the sort of rhetoric around outpatient commitment that we've encountered over the years, and in some cases in the states that we've been involved in or consulted with. This one came up around the passage of Laura's law in California, one of the more recent outpatient commitment laws. And the director of the Mind Freedom Organization, David Oakes, said the following: "Today, the forced drugging common inside of institutions has climbed over the walls and is now out in our communities. Citizens in the USA and parts of the world living peacefully at home are now court-ordered to take powerful psychiatric drugs against their will. Typically, these are neuroleptic drugs that can cause structural brain damage and even kill." So this is you get a taste for some of the rhetoric around this. Then on the other side, the chief proponent of AOT is E. Fuller Torrey, who many of you should know. And his organization, called TAC, has its main objective advancing inpatient and outpatient commitment laws. And so he said the following: "Civil libertarians have made it almost impossible to treat psychotic individuals who refuse care. These misguided activists have created a morass of legal obstacles that prevents us from helping many psychotic individuals until they have a finger on the trigger." And that's a key phrase that will follow. "It's time to reverse course. Mandatory treatment for those too ill to recognize they need help is far more humane than our present mandatory non-treatment." And Fuller goes on from there to analogize to things like Alzheimer's disease and saying, well, if you had an elderly parent who was incapacitated, no fair or humane society would let that person wander on the streets. And it's actually a fairly compelling argument. And Fuller is very articulate and focused individual. Now, another strategist who's on Fuller's side, although he is in a different organization, is D.J. Jaffe. And when the Kendra's Law was being debated in New York, he said the following. Laws, and he was speaking in this case to NAMI. So it was a NAMI meeting about whether National Alliance for Mental Illness was going to support AOT statutes, in this case in New York. So D.J. Jaffe said, and he still says this, laws change for a single reason, in reaction to highly publicized incidents of violence. People care about public safety. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that this is the reality. So if you're changing outpatient commitment laws on your state, you have to understand that. You have to take the debate out of the mental health arena and put it in the criminal justice public safety arena. And unfortunately, I think that view is probably pretty correct. And D.J. Jaffe continues to be a strategist and very involved in the AOT debate in New York. So what are the criteria for AOT? This is sort of typical criteria that are very similar across states. These are the ones in North Carolina. Presence of a serious mental illness, the capacity to survive in the community with available supports, a clinical history indicating a need for treatment to prevent deterioration that would predictably result in dangerousness. So that's the preventative or the prophylactic element of it. And then a mental status that limits and negates the individual's ability to make informed decisions to seek or comply voluntarily with recommended treatment. So those are the criteria. If a person shows up, say, in an emergency room in North Carolina, they meet that criteria, the person can be put immediately on outpatient commitment status and does not need to be hospitalized. And North Carolina has a separate set of criteria for inpatient commitment. So, and, you know, there are some variants on these criteria, but they are fairly similar in the newer states that have these preventative statutes. So Jeff and I wanted to design a randomized trial of outpatient commitment. And so over a period of time, negotiated a RCT in the north central region of North Carolina. So this is along up from central North Carolina around where the Raleigh-Durham Airport is, up to the Virginia border. And so we went to these counties, and actually one more county was added later, Guilford County, where Greensboro is. And the basic proposition we approached these counties with, these were each community mental health centers. So Vance, Granville, Franklin, Warren was one mental health center. Orange, Person, Chatham was another. Durham was one mental health center, and then Guilford was a single county mental health center as well. And within it, there were a series of hospitals, but basically one state hospital that these counties fed into. So this was, in some ways, a catchment area for the public mental health system in the north central part of North Carolina. And so we approached the state hospital and all the hospitals in that region that had appreciable numbers of psychiatric patients and said, would you be willing to suspend disbelief about whether outpatient commitment works or not and enter into this experiment whereby patients who are leaving the hospital and are going to be released on outpatient commitment, we will randomly assign to either stay on their order or to be released from the order. So 50% of them would be released from the outpatient commitment order. They already had the status of an outpatient commitment order that they would leave the hospital under. And to the patient, we offered this same deal with the condition that they would get additional case management services if they accepted the deal, and that we'd pay them also for our interviews and participating in the study. So from the patient's point of view, it was a good deal. They had a 50-50 chance of beating the rap and getting paid to beat the rap. So the negotiations around this study were long, in that we had to negotiate with each of these, the clinical units within the region, the hospitals in the region, and then plenty of attorneys who represented either the hospital, the clinicians, and then also this was three judicial districts. So we were kind of surprised that it happened. We're not quite sure why it happened, although the judges were the key people to approve it or to agree to it, and judges in North Carolina at that level are elected officials, and they were sort of happy to get the attention, and we had, you know, lovely research assistants, and so they were happy. And so it may be a study that wouldn't be repeated, but it did happen, and this was the main result. The primary outcome was rehospitalization. And if you look month to month on a repeated measures analysis of rehospitalization, what we found is that folks who were randomly assigned to the outpatient commitment group, so these were folks who were going to get outpatient commitment if they were re-upped, if they went back to court for a year, the folks that were assigned to that experimental group had a third lower odds of rehospitalization over the year. The folks in the control group were immunized against outpatient commitment. They could not be outpatient committed. If they were, we went back to court and released them. We had the authority to release them from the court order. So you had these two groups. One had case management alone, and one had case management plus outpatient commitment. One thing we didn't foresee in the design of the study is that because people got doses of outpatient commitment, like the initial court order typically was 30 to 90 days, they had to go back to court. The clinicians in that area program had to take them back to court or to reinitiate their outpatient commitment order. And in many cases, the clinicians chose not to go back to court. And so we ended up with a dose effect where people had varying doses of outpatient commitment, which was not something we had anticipated happening and wasn't anything we could control. As a result, there was sort of a stratification in that there were folks who got short doses of outpatient commitment and patients who got longer doses of outpatient commitment. And here is a typical way we ended up talking about the results, which in some ways led to a lot of criticism of our findings because people said, well, you did this post hoc stratification of the findings and you were kind of cooking the data. We did this because we thought this was sort of the more responsible way to present the data. And we did have the original findings. But most people, you know, when you talk about the study, will say, well, they only had these post hoc findings. At any rate, if you look at people who got less than 6 months of outpatient commitment, essentially they did no better than the control group. But if they got 6 months or more of outpatient commitment, they were significantly less likely to be rehospitalized. And they had a much shorter length of stay. So the folks who had more than 6 months of outpatient commitment had a typical length of stay of about 7.5 days compared to the people in the control group or people who got 180 days or less, which is about a month of hospitalization. So a significant decrease in hospitalization. We then did a series of analyses and published over the years in the minimum publishable unit and found the following, that in addition to reducing hospitalization, we found that, one, generally outpatient commitment had to be applied for an extended period of time to be effective and had to be delivered in concert with frequent mental health services. So we found that unless people got frequent mental health services, the outpatient commitment order in and of itself was ineffective. It was only people who got frequent mental health services and extended periods of outpatient commitment, 180 days or more, plus those services, that actually did well. We found under those conditions that outpatient commitment could reduce violence, victimization, family strain, arrests, and improve medication adherence and quality of life. However, it had to be delivered that way. It had to be an extended period of outpatient commitment. It had to be frequent services for those effects to be rendered. By and large, I mean, there was some that victimization actually didn't require that condition, but all the others did. However, one of the criticisms of these findings, again, was that we were not able to control the dose of outpatient commitment. Around this same time, New York had chosen to pilot outpatient commitment under a statute called assisted outpatient treatment, and the first pilot of that was at Bellevue Hospital. And we worked with PRA in New York to do the to do the evaluation of the pilot that was a randomized trial as well at Bellevue Hospital. And what happened there was the folks, a very similar design, either got enhanced services, so they got much more intensive services than we offered, and the court order in a pilot that was conducted at only Bellevue Hospital and was conducted during this pilot phase of the statute in which it was not enforced. So it was a peculiar RCT in that it had a very small sample size, and throughout the study, the sheriffs and police departments were arguing about who was going to enforce the statute. So the outcome was that the findings were that there were no differences between AOT and enhanced services, folks who just got, say, assertive community treatment alone versus assertive community treatment with the AOT order. There were no differences in outcomes between those groups. And the limitations of that study was that, one, it was a small sample size, and also it was the startup. This was the trial that was going to set the stage for New York going statewide or not with AOT. And it looked like there would be no statewide statute because the findings were definitively, no benefit to AOT. However, around the time that the statute was coming forward, Kendra Webdale was killed. And as reported in the New York Times, in an incident that has gnawed at New Yorkers' sense of security, Kendra Webdale was killed in January 1999 when Andrew Goldstein, a 30-year-old schizophrenic, picked her up on the platform of a 23rd Street subway station and threw her into the path of an oncoming train. And there you see I add the picture there because this was part of the ethos of Kendra's law. And the then Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, became an advocate for the law. He approached the Webdale family and said, "Would you lend your name to this statute?" And it then passed the legislature in New York with this first of a kind statute in mental health called Kendra's Law. And there was an additional piece of this that made it go down less lumpy in the face of the fierce opposition in New York. This was fiercely opposed by mental health advocates in New York because they had actually tried to prevent the pilot statute from happening. They had tried to make the evaluation very limited, and were just opposed at every step to the law. So when it was put forward, in a way to sort of sweeten the deal, they added $32 million. The Pataki administration proposed, and the legislature passed a package that included a $32 million implementation package, and then $125 million yearly for enhanced community services. And this is a huge win for the mental health advocacy community because they said, well, maybe we don't like the statute, but we'll get a huge increase in assertive community treatment teams and a huge increase in intensive case management slots in New York. And it also created these single point of access programs where folks coming into each mental health area would be assigned services. And so it was a huge infusion of new dollars into the state of New York. And so advocates who had been opposed said, well, maybe this isn't such a bad deal. And so Kendra's Law passed and was implemented in New York and was passed as a 5-year statute that would sundown. This also started a series of statutes in which were passage of preventative statutes named after the victim of violence, the hand of a mentally ill person. So Laura's Law in California and Kevin's Law in Michigan and several others. So in the intervening time, New York had the first 5 years starting in 2000 of Kendra's Law, and it was sunsetting after 5 years. The New York Office of Mental Health, OMH, did an internal evaluation as required by the legislature prior to the re-upping of the statute. OMH found that the statute was very effective, but advocates there said, well, OMH did it. They cooked the data. It was an internal evaluation. We don't accept this. And so two things happened. The legislature re-upped for another 5 years and required an independent evaluation of the statute. And so we then bid with PRA on the evaluation of Kendra's Law. When we additionally were working with the MacArthur Research Network on mandated community treatment, so between some of the resources that the MacArthur Network put in and the dollars available for the evaluation from OMH, we were the successful bidders. And so we then worked with the MacArthur Network, with PRA, on the evaluation of Kendra's Law. Now, I recommend you go and read it. It's online on the OMH website and our website, but I'm just going to give you a little bit of the findings. The way the evaluation was structured, we had a series of questions, 5 questions that we had to answer about the law that were opposed by the legislature. I'm just going to give you some of the salient findings from the report. So the first area had to do with what were the outcomes for recipients. And we found that there were substantial reductions in psychiatric hospitalizations and in days of hospital for folks who were under AOT in the period of time in which AOT was in effect in the state of New York. We found modest evidence that AOT reduces arrests. We found that there were substantial increases in receipt of intensive case management services for folks who were put under Kendra's Law. We found that recipients were more likely to adhere to psychotropic medications, and we found other subjective improvements in personal functioning. I'll show you the data on a few of these areas. So in terms of rehospitalization, the first column is the period prior to AOT. So for folks who were before they got their first AOT order, there, 14% had a hospitalization each month prior to going on AOT. After they went on AOT, after the court order started, in the first 6 months of AOT there, the rate of hospitalization was reduced to 11%. And then in the next 7 to 12 months, only 9% were admitted. So a significant reduction in rehospitalization. In terms of length of stay under AOT, if you were hospitalized prior to AOT, the typical length of stay was 18 days. After AOT was instituted, length of stay went down to an average of 11 days in the first 6 months, and then 7 to 12 months to 10 days. So significant reduction in the number of hospitalizations and the length of stay. In terms of medication possession, so did folks get medication and did they fill their medication? Here we looked at, did the person get medication that was appropriate to their condition? So if they had a diagnosis of schizophrenia, did they have an antipsychotic? If they had a bipolar disorder, did they have appropriate? So we matched the medication and the fill rate of the medication to the diagnosis. And what we found is that prior to AOT, only 35% were regularly receiving their medications appropriate to their condition. But in the first 6 months, it went up to 44%. And then the next 7 to 12 months, it went up to 50%. Now, you could look at this and say, well, this seems low. I mean, under AOT, you're only getting to about 50%. We actually think that these numbers probably don't represent all their medication fills. And so we don't interpret these data as an absolute number, but rather demonstrating a trend of use of Medicaid fills to show the greater medication possession. We also show here that the arrests were significantly less likely once someone went on AOT. So prior to AOT, the arrest rate was about 3.7, and then when they're on AOT, the rate went down to 1.9. That's the adjusted percent arrested in a month. If they got enhanced services, so if they got, say, assertive community treatment, which was not an experimental condition, but we selected a group of people who around the same time started on assertive community treatment or intensive case management without the court order, There was some improvement in arrests, but that was not significant. So we found a modest decrease in arrests under AOT. So just to summarize these findings, and the findings from the report, what we concluded was that New York State's AOT program improves a range of important outcomes for its recipients. And so we document a lot of other areas in which the outcomes improved. And we found that and concluded that the increased services available under AOT clearly improve recipient outcomes. And many of the advocates argue, well, it's the services that come with AOT that improve the outcomes. And so we acknowledge here that, yes, the services that come bundled with AOT and affect the leverage of the court to leverage services is an important part of the AOT success. However, we also concluded that the AOT court order itself and its monitoring appear to offer additional benefits in improving outcomes, so that we argue over and above the effect of increased services that come in effect with the court order, there is something about the court order itself and the monitoring that does have a beneficial effect on the outcomes that we measure. We also found that we could not detect any increase in perceived coercion or negative perceptions of treatment associated with the court order. It's also important to recognize that the AOT order exerts a critical effect on service providers. And I think this is an important point, is that in terms of the data we had and the interviews we conducted through key stakeholder interviews, it was clear that service providers who had a patient under AOT felt that they really had to pay attention to that person, that they had to prioritize their care, and that they knew that the sort of, the eye of the law was on them as well, because people were monitoring the quality of care they provided. We also found that when AOT ends, that sustained improvements are in part an effect of how long the original court order was. So if you had a longer court order, you tended to have a more sustained effect than a shorter court order. One of the final questions, which is a really interesting question, is, well, what was the effect of AOT on the system as a whole? Did the people who got AOT squeeze out the other people? And this is another huge criticism of AOT, because people say, well, you're taking people who don't want treatment, who don't want to be served, you're putting them at the head of the queue. What about all these voluntary folks who want treatment who aren't going to get it because the people who don't want it are at the head of the queue? And what we found, and this is a sort of complicated effect, is that in the early years of AOT, in fact, this did happen. That when you had the new services not yet in place, remember there was this big infusion of $123 million into the New York State system, it took several years for that to ramp up. So in the early years, yes, AOT recipients were far more likely to get ACT and intensive case management services. But as the service system ramped up and as the new dollars infused into the system, for those years, really AOT and non-AOT people were just about as likely to get the same service package. However, and also there was a leveling of the number of new cases, we do acknowledge in the report that that was sort of at a point in time in a system that was growing, and that which in the future, when you have highly constrained dollars and funding decreases, this kind of picture of competition for services might change. And in fact, maybe AOT recipients will be more likely and squeeze out services for non-AOT candidates. And then finally, I'm just going to talk very briefly about the cost impact. And so we did additional studies, not part of the evaluation, funded by the MacArthur Foundation, again, through the Research Network on Mandated Community Treatment, and also the Stanley Research Foundation. We looked at the cost impact of AOT both in New York and North Carolina. So we monetized the original study we had done in North Carolina in the 90s, and then inflating to the present. And then we also looked at what happened in New York. So this is what North Carolina looked like in the RCT that we talked about. The control group, folks who did not get outpatient commitment, their total services and criminal and court costs were about $43,000 in 2010 dollars. However, if they got outpatient commitment, it was about the same cost. But remember, there was this issue about how much of a dose of outpatient commitment. And so if you got a short dose of outpatient commitment, actually your service costs went up, your total costs went up. However, if you got a longer period, so if you got more than 6 months generally of outpatient commitment and the types of services we talked about, then the costs came almost in half to $25,922. So what we found in North Carolina, which was similar to most of the findings from our own study, is that if it was applied in a longer dose with frequent services, the costs dropped dramatically. In New York, and these are new data that we're about to publish, we found considerable cost savings with the AOT program as well. If you look at the first column, that's the AOT baseline. So those are folks before they receive AOT, and you see in that stacked bar graph, the light blue is inpatient and the dark blue outpatient, criminal justice and administrative buckets. That prior to AOT, so at the AOT baseline, the costs were about $120,000 per patient. In the first year of AOT, their costs dropped to about $60,000 per patient. And then in the second year, for the folks who stayed on AOT, their total cost dropped to about $40,000. So significant cost savings. And what you see largely is that what happens is inpatient gets reduced and outpatient increases. And the contribution of the administrative cost and the criminal justice cost is not substantial. So the main action is around reducing inpatient and a compensatory increase in outpatient costs. Now, it was very hard to do this as a comparison because there's no group that really compares the AOT group because they've been selected by the criteria as being pretty tough patients to treat. So we did try to select a comparable group in terms of hospitalizations and in terms of other criteria, and those are what we call the ES, or Enhanced Services Baseline. You see, though, that even at baseline, their costs are nowhere near what the cost of AOT patients are, and so their typical yearly cost is about $70,000. And then in the first year of something like assertive community treatment, their costs go down to about $58,000, and then they drop further to around $38,000. So what you see then is that there's a larger decrease in cost for the AOT patients, but enhanced services patients also have decreased use of services and decreased costs. So this is sort of where we are. We're about to publish these findings both for North Carolina and New York. Where the New York story is they have, after our report came out, they re-upped for 5 years again. And so there is no permanent statute still in New York, but we're wondering what effect this will have to demonstrate the cost impact, the favorable cost impact of Kendra's Law in New York. So this is hopefully a work in progress. And now I'll turn you over to Jeff, who will talk about sort of another major piece of the work we've been doing together.